from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. This week and next, we're going to catch up on some of our summer reading and bring you some new and recent interviews with authors we think you might want to consider for your summer reading list. We'll start with my interview with author Marcy Jefferson.
I'll talk with author Ben Winters about his last installment in his Last Policeman trilogy.
Aw, and I'll take a look at a new biography of painter William Forsythe. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Fort Wayne author Marcy Jefferson grew up in an Air Force family, and all that moving around inspired her interest in history. A trip to London a few years ago ignited in her an interest in 17th century history, when Francis Stuart captured the hearts of Louis XIV, Charles II, and James II. Sharon Gamble invited Marcy to tell us how she brought Francis Stuart to life for her novel, The Girl and the Golden Coin. Marcy began by reading a passage.
Francis Stuart, among many things, she was known for something a little bit unusual for women of her time. She sometimes dressed as a man. Now, this gave her a little bit of freedom to move around. I think it really originated as sort of a court theatrical where she would play the part of a man in a little court theater, and it really sort of was found very entertaining. You know, the kings really enjoyed this kind of fun diversion, and so she did this from time to time. Many portraits are painted of Frances Stuart in her male attire, and I have a scene from about midway through the novel where Frances is dressed as a man at a birthday party for the king at a rival's apartment at the palace, and she gets herself into a little bit of an adventure as she's leaving the party. So I'll go ahead and begin.
Great.
I took a glass from a footman and stepped onto the balcony overlooking the privy garden. It was enclosed as an aviary, and birds scattered as I leaned against the bars to catch my breath. As I sipped my wine, I caught sight of a lady rushing through the grounds. Something about her gait was familiar, and when she reached the garden door, I recognized her. Prudence, the little fool, will get herself arrested. Prudence, by the way, is Frances Stuart's Quaker maid. The lifeguards let her slip out, and she turned left toward the King Street Gate, the open city, and Westminster. I moved through Castlemaine's guests as casually as I could. When I reached the stairs, I flew down and went through a closed door onto King Street. She disappeared through the King Street Gate, and I walked that direction so as not to raise suspicion from the guards at the Privy Garden wall. At the gate, I peeped through. The gables on the many taverns and houses towered overhead, making the road seem narrower than it was. I pulled my cavalier hat down tight on my head and slipped out. I ran after her, keeping close to the tavern walls. Prue, I called, but she rushed onward. A scantily dressed woman emerged from the shadows. Oi, gent, here's your lady. Startled, I stepped aside, tripping into the sludge of the road. I ran ahead with only the candles from the tavern windows to light my way. I caught Prudence by the arm just before she rounded a corner. Come with me. She spun around, struggled, peered at my face, then looked guilty as sin. Sorry, m'lady, I was just going to meet my friends. Your Quaker friends? The militia will beat you. Do you want to get yourself transported to the Americas? She tried to break free, but I wouldn't let go. You're coming back with me. Just then, two militiamen stepped out of a tavern across the street. The sounds of beer mugs clanking and laughter spilled out behind them. You got one of them Quakers, m'lord? One of them called. We can help you. I froze. Should I run? Draw my scabbard? Nay, I called in a deep voice. The scantily dressed woman reappeared. A tavern window opened. Nay, I said again. Just a two-penny whore who thinks she's worth three. Prudence stopped struggling and gaped at me. The men laughed and went back inside. I hauled her by the arm all the way down the street, through King Street Gate, through the guards at the privy door, and under the torches of the privy garden before I released her. Go back to bed, I said, short of breath, and if you value your life, you won't do that again. That's just it, she muttered. I do value my life, and I think I ought to be able to do as I wish. You certainly do. I stared at her a moment. I promised King Charles I'd look after you, so you can't. and that's it. So you get a little bit glimpse of 17th century London and the dangers of the streets outside of the palace walls and a little bit of the religious conflict going on at the time.
Yeah. You know, I love this character, Frances Stewart, as you've made her come to light. I would love to, you know, be friends with her, go out to dinner with her. And she's certainly, you know, she's protecting a woman who's her servant here. And, you know, she doesn't really need to do that. She is in a social and political position where she could just as easily turn Prudence in for the transgression of being a Quaker. But she doesn't. She protects this young lady.
And that is very much Frances Stewart's style. She's a very loyal person, very loving. She makes a great many sacrifices for the betterment of her family and her country.
So you moved around a lot as a child. Is that what got you interested in the history of all the places you were moving? Because one of your parents was in the Air Force, right?
That is correct. And yes, I moved all around the South. I lived in the Philippines two times, and I lived in Yorktown, Virginia. And yes, I do think living in all of these different places really sparked my interest in history and culture. And I just felt the need to learn the background of a place once I tried to set roots down, and I think really particularly Yorktown, where the Revolutionary War was sort of won there. It was the final battle. That's really where I got really involved in not only American history, but, you know, if you study American history so far back, to a certain point it kind of becomes British history. We were all British at one point.
Right.
So I really kind of just kept on, you know, sort of studying farther and farther back. And that's, I think, where the interest in the British monarchy sort of came about, once I started studying the British history.
Well, most of our listeners, I'd venture to say, are fans of Downton Abbey on our sister PBS affiliate. So, you know, it's not surprising that we're all kind of drawn to, whether our families came here from Germany or Italy, there's something about the motherland of England that we're just fascinated by the period drama of it. And life is just enough different under a monarchy than it is in the United States that becomes a source of just complete fascination and curiosity for most of us.
Definitely. You know, we don't have monarchs per se. You know, we don't have a ruler. We have our president, who is, of course, very popular and very public figure. We have superstars. We have movie stars. We have big business who certainly wield a certain amount of perhaps political and certainly financial power, but there's just something so intriguing about a royal who they claim their place because of their ancestral blood and their connections and their history. And we don't, being only a couple hundred years old ourselves, we Americans don't have that long history, those roots that go back hundreds of years like these aristocrats do. And you know, so I think it is just natural for us to be intrigued. And we're not the only ones. Of course, most of the British love their royalty.
Sure.
They revere them, and they're very proud to be able to look to these figures. And, you know, really back, it was always this way. Back in the late 17th century, the time of Frances Stewart, the royals were superstars. There were no movie stars. You know, there were a few theaters, and there were a handful of actresses who became famous, but they were the talk of the town. They were what there was to talk about.
And long before the current British tabloids that look into every potential scandal, there were rumors, and Frances Stewart is right. I've got to be careful how I talk about this, because there's some secrets revealed as the novel goes along. So if I start to say something, just stop me, okay?
Sure,
but she's right there in the sort of the crosshairs of the political alliances and misalliances between France and Great Britain.
That's right. These are the two major political players of the century, King of France, Louis XIV, and Charles II of England. In 1660, they both sort of came of age and began their personal rule, and they were in the center of all of the wars that happened. They were fighting for, you know, trading powers. And Frances is a very rare kind of figure. She is one who sort of walks the line between both, because as a British royalist, after the civil wars, were lost. She was a royalist. That meant she was on the king's side. The king lost those wars. And so she, with the king, was exiled from England for a long period until finally England got tired of the Puritan ruler, Oliver Cromwell, and they restored their king. So she, when she was in exile, went to France. And so she got to know the French court and nobles, and particularly the French king, Louis XIV, known as the Sun King of France. And, you know, he kind of, I won't want to give too much away,
sure.
But he falls in love with her. And she has, you know, secrets to keep, like you mentioned, and people to protect, and she does reject him, and that makes him angry, and he uses her then, sends her to England, her homeland, to the her very, very distant cousin, Charles II, to kind of spy on him and become, you know, sort of a figure to help him, Louis, align with Charles, and she... He calls on her to stop a war. So she's very involved in everything that's going on. She's sort of a little-known spectator. That her story hasn't really been told very often. So she's very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So you've clearly spent years researching this. Tell us about your primary documents. Were there letters you were able to see and read? Or what were some of your source materials?
Well, actually, I did spend years researching this, too long probably. There's one biography by Hartman Hughes, written, gosh, I think it might have been published in the 1930s, and she hasn't had a biography published since. But it was an excellent, excellent starting point for all of my additional research. He didn't really expound on her years in France, but I was able to sort of piece that together by studying the biographies of her family members, other people that were exiled with her in France. But yes, there were certainly diarists. Samuel Pepys was a famous diarist writing during the Restoration period in England, and he kept very close tabs on Frances Stuart. He was fascinated by her. There were wills and letters between courtiers that I was able to read, and like I said, I sort of found out that they existed by reading biographies and material that I could get my hands on here, and then I was actually able to, through the internet, connect with some archivists in England who sent me transcripts of these letters that were just mentioned in biographies. I actually got to read the entire thing and found out a little bit more about you know, what she was doing and even what she was wearing back, you know, during her adventures in late 17th century.
Yeah, and I don't mean by talking about the research to in any way make this imaginative act any less important, because you've figured out how to convey, you know, the texture of fabrics, what the clothes looked like, what the streets smelled like. So there's a great act of imagination behind this novel.
Yes, you're quite right about that. Historical fiction is sort of hard that way. You know, I did push my imagination into overdrive. Really, for each and every scene, for every historical fact that I studied, I sort of uncovered a new set of questions and led to more study. And, you know, it's one thing to know what happened in a period, but it's another to decide how to make, how it made a character feel, and yet another to know how to make the reader feel it through the right choice of words. You know, I felt like I couldn't let Frances Stuart walk down a hallway without knowing if her footsteps would echo or fall on soft carpet, whether she was nervous or bored, and how the walls looked, and yeah, even what it smelled like. Those are things that we experience. That gives life texture.
If you had lived in that era and had known Frances Stuart, what do you think you would have liked to have done together?
Oh, what a great question. First of all, I would have to get a smallpox booster.
That's right.
Because it's quite a different time. It's quite a dangerous time, like I said. So I would definitely opt for the safety of Whitehall Palace. But I might have to brush up on my courtier skills and learn how to be manipulative and sort of tough. But if I did have the opportunity to just hang out with Frances for a while, I think I would choose to go back to the time during Queen Catherine's birthday ball. I won't give away too much. It's
sure.
Just sort of a moment in the novel where Frances Stuart, you know, she wore this silver lace gown, and she had all of these diamonds. She was spotted being the best dancer, and, you know, it's a moment in the novel where her external struggles are sort of behind her, and she was unaware of sort of the internal struggles that are about to fall upon her. It was like a moment of triumph for her, and that would have been a great time to go back and kind of hang out and check out her jewelry and ask to borrow a gown and learn how to do those English dances. But I would really just try to take the opportunity to sit down and talk to her, have a glass of tea with her, or a cup or a dish of tea, as they would have had. And I would ask her if I guessed all of her secrets and got her story right.
Sharon Gamble with Fort Wayne author Marcy Jefferson. Her novel is set in the 17th century and reimagines the life of Frances Stuart, who captured the hearts of Louis XIV, Charles II, and James II. It's called The Girl on the Golden Coin, and it's available at bookstores everywhere. Learn more at marcyjefferson.com. That's Marcy, M-A-R-C-I, Jefferson.com.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. World of Trouble is the last book in Ben Winter's trilogy that began with award-winning The Last Policeman. It comes out on July 15th. The Last Policeman and its two sequels follow the adventures of a policeman in New Hampshire as he solves crimes while all around him civilization is breaking down as a massive Earth-destroying asteroid draws ever closer. Travis DiNicola spoke with Ben Winters about the books.
Ben, welcome back to Art of the Matter. Great to see you.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And congratulations on the completion of your trilogy of books.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be, I'm a little sad to be done, but also glad.
Yeah, I'm sure. But pretty exciting. It's such a fun series. Maybe fun's an odd word to use for end of the world stuff. So we kind of know how, at least we think we know how it's going to end. The third book has not quite come out yet. It will be released to Indie Reads Books, I'm really excited to say, on the 12th.
I'm excited to say
July.
Too.
Very cool. And then available everywhere else on the 15th. So we think we know that the world ends in the book at the end of the series. But why don't you set up sort of the world of the trilogy for us, if you will?
Sure. Well, basically, the Last Policeman trilogy follows a young police detective over a series of adventures. In the first book, he is trying to figure out who killed this guy, an insurance agent. In the second book, he's looking for a missing person. In the third book, he's looking for another missing person with whom he has a close connection.
Mm-hmm.
What makes it all a little different than your typical mystery series is that, as you say, the world is set to end via deadly asteroid in about a year's time from the opening of the first book. So the whole series takes place over the last about 10 months before this asteroid slams into the planet, an asteroid of roughly the size of the one that killed the dinosaurs.
Yeah, that's a pretty big asteroid.
It is a pretty big asteroid, and it's about as big a one as I could realistically conjure into existence. You know, it's very unlikely that this sort of thing is going to happen, but it is at least somewhat possible. There is the slimmest of possibilities. And I wanted this series to take place in some sort of realistic universe.
And at this point, the people of the world know that it's coming sometime in the fall. They don't know the exact date. And pretty much the speculation is everyone's going to be gone, but maybe there might be a few survivors.
Yeah. Well, first of all, they actually, by the beginning of the third book, I think this is right. I'm looking back from my own writing. I think we do know the exact date, and they know that they know the approximate location also, which, again, this is based in science. An object gets close enough to Earth, scientists can predict fairly accurately where and when it's going to hit and the angle of impact, all of which helps them to predict the amount of damage that it would do. The object that I've imagined, yes, will probably kill most people, not necessarily everyone right away.
Sure.
The thing to keep in mind, and this is really fun to chat about, the thing to keep in mind is that an object of this size, a lot of people would die right away, but then Earth's atmosphere would be changed in a lot of very, very dramatic ways. You'd have a lot of ash blocking out the sun for quite a long time, which would sort of blot out photosynthesis, which would make it very hard to grow crops, make it very hard to keep alive livestock, and that's just one of the ways that life would get real hard, real fast after an event like this.
So there's a little bit of hoarding going on.
There is a little bit of hoarding. There's an economic collapse, and there's also sort of human desperation and a lot of people making very difficult choices about how to live these last few months of their lives.
I think that's actually, for me, what's the most fascinating thing about the series. It's you know, in the first book, you introduce this idea that, you know, there's a lot of people who are falling through on their bucket list, whatever that may be. The other, you know, whether they're, you know, going off to travel, whether they're hooking up with someone they always wanted to, leaving their spouse, staying with their spouse, quitting their job. You know, there's some suicides. It seems like everybody's smoking because they can.
And not just cigarettes either.
Right, right. You know, and so you've got, you know, a lot of things like that. So everyone's kind of, you know, it's really sort of heightening everyone's sense of what they want out of life or what they care about. And in a way, I mean, your main character, Hank Pallas, he's kind of doing the same thing. I mean, for him, the way that he's kind of dealing with the inevitability of it is by still trying to solve crimes.
Well, right. That's the thing about Detective Pallas, is that even given a landscape in which most people are abandoning what they've always done to sort of frantically do new things, he considers it his obligation and his moral and professional responsibility to continue being a detective, because that's his job. He took an oath, and he sort of feels like, well, it doesn't matter what's going to happen at the end of the year. What is happening right now is that there is crime, and I have sworn to solve crimes. And so that, I think, is part of what people respond to in the books, is that kind of case study in human psychology. What kind of person is this who hews to his course, you know, who keeps on hoeing his row, like, even when there's so much chaos all around?
And even when, you know, other members of the police force are saying, look, don't bother, you know? I mean, you know, he's in the first book, he's trying to figure out if something's really a murder or not, and they're saying, look, even if it is a murder, what are you going to do, lock him away for life? Well, I mean, the world's ending in 10 months.
Who cares, right?
Right.
But to Hank, you know, to Detective Pallas, it's like justice is justice, right? Mm-hmm. And if every murder victim deserves to have the case solved and prosecuted, then why is this person any different? Just because they happen to have been murdered at this particular juncture in human history. So hopefully that's interesting. And to me, I like all that you said about the choices people are making, and people are going off to do this and that and smoking this and that. It's like, this to me is always what was interesting, not the contemplation of what Earth will be like after a catastrophe, but the contemplation of what it would be like when everybody knows that this catastrophe is coming and everybody at once is faced with their imminent mortality. How does that upend everything?
And you can't help, as a reader, to not start playing a what-if game. Like, what if I was in that position?
Yeah.
You know, what if I was in this world? What would I do if I knew there were 10 months for the, you know, the Earth to be, still be around?
Yeah, I get a lot of interesting emails from readers, which is really fun, just on that exact thing. And the thing that, to me, is really interesting, that I sort of discovered or fully understood in researching these novels, is that what you think you would do and what you think you'd be able to do would very quickly run into a lot of problems, you know, because everyone sort of thinks, oh, well, yeah, I mean, if there wasn't, I would, you know, I would go to the Bahamas and I would sit on the beach and I'd eat wedding cake. You know, I'd do all this. But like, who do you think is going to be flying the plane? Who do you think is
going to
the busboy is going to be at the hotel in the Bahamas? Like, if everybody is trying to pursue their bucket list, that makes
making that wedding cake?
Exactly. Who's baking? And that makes it very hard for individuals to do it.
Yeah.
And so very quickly I started thinking about, and I hope this is reflected in the novels, like how deeply our civilization, our society is interwoven, how everybody's choices and everyone's decisions every day affect everyone else's.
Yeah.
You know, like we only get to eat because there are these people out there who are farmers who decide every day they're going to keep on farming, you know, and then there are truckers who decide to keep on shipping stuff. We take that all completely for granted. You know, you just go into the marsh, you go, oh, well, there's beef. Great. I'm glad that's there. That'll always be there. And then you start to contemplate a scenario where the world is going to end in 10 months, and you call an agricultural economist, as I did, you know, and say, well, how far out are people planning, you know, their livestock? How far out are people planting? When does that start to wither away? You know, it's really, really interesting.
It seems like, to me, at least in the first book, you know, so, you know, whatever, we're 10 months out, like the first couple months of all this knowledge, to some extent, the economy, society, things are starting to fray. But for the most part, it's all sort of holding together. And then there's this tipping point where it all of a sudden, in the second book, especially Countdown City, things just go to hell very quickly.
Yeah.
It's like, boom, all of a sudden, you know, you've hit a point where everything just breaks down.
Yeah, I have
and
a character.
And it's like overnight almost.
Yeah, I have a character predict it, and then it comes to pass. It's when the water stops coming out of the taps. It's like it is, as you say, Travis, it's a tipping point.
Yeah.
Where suddenly people realize that, wow, this is really bad, you know, and talk about things that we take for granted, and actually we're lucky in this country to take it for granted, but a plentiful supply of fresh drinking water, without that, very quickly, just the day-to-day possibility of a of existence becomes a navigation, becomes something you have to figure out all the time. So and even besides all that, I'm hoping that what people like about these books is that at the center of each of them, this all this stuff that we're talking about is the background. It's the periphery.
Right.
At the center of
the
book, you've got this
plot.
Man solving cases.
Uh-huh.
You know, I've got these in the, at the center of each book is almost a classic or traditional set of detective stories where there is a big question to be answered, and my guy is trying to answer it piece by piece, working the clues, sort of shoulder to the, what's the expression, nose to the grindstone, working his way through these cases. And the end of the world, as far as Detective Palace is concerned, it's just a series of obstacles to him getting his man, you know?
Right.
It's like
he's
that's
still on
that's,
the case.
He's on the case. And like that's why we love thrillers and detective fiction and mysteries. It's like you're watching this hero, this man or this woman, or who, you know, try to get to the bottom of something, and there's all this stuff in the way. You know, people lying, people trying to kill them, you know, all the clues. And here we've got someone who's trying to solve these crimes, and there's all these obstacles that just happen to be coming from the fact that civilization is falling apart.
And a lot of people just don't trust him because they're like, why would you still be working on a case? Like, what's really going on here, right?
So there's the double question of motivation that I play with. I hope, you know, throughout the stories I'm playing with this idea of not only why did this guy commit this crime, but why does this guy care so much?
Yeah.
Why is he working this case? And people keep asking him that throughout the novels. What is your, what's your deal, man? You know, what's, why do you care so much? And at times I think that Detective Palace can almost be cruel in the way that he forces other people to participate in his investigations. And he takes time away from other people's precious remaining time to help him.
Yeah.
And I hopefully I don't shy away from that, you know.
So, you know, without giving too much away about the third book, and the third book's titled World of Trouble, you know, I was thinking about this before our interview, sort of like, how do I ask you about what happens in the third book? And I guess this is the way I'm going to go about it. For me, the first book, The Last Policeman, could be made as a low-budget, independent film and really maintain the spirit of the book. You come into Countdown City and you're talking like, you know, huge Hollywood, you know, crazy summer blockbuster, you know, Tom Cruise, you know, just, you know, massive movie, because there's almost no way to get around because things just start getting out of hand.
I've got some riots in the street and where, so on in the second book,
So, okay, third book, where do you go from there?
Well, I mean, you can almost, Travis, go back. First of all, I like that. I like this. I like the way you're talking. In the third book, in World of Trouble, you can almost go back to this, to the kind of low-budget independent picture.
Okay.
Right? Because in the third book, because society is broken down so much, Palace has almost no communication with other people.
So it's, you know, all on a smaller scale.
It's on a small, right.
Yeah.
You hear a lot in the book about what's going on in the outside world, and there's some radio communication. You know, there's some moments of remembering things that he encountered on his way to where the third novel takes place, which is really a pretty desolate location.
Okay.
And there's, I mean, there's literally a bunker in the novel, you know, so there's a kind of burrowing in as we get toward the end, because World of Trouble, it does, it takes place 2 weeks before the scheduled detonation, you know, implosion of the world. So it's very much the last moments, and he's sort of far away from his comfort zone, from the city of Concord, New Hampshire, where he came from. And he is, he's sort of dug in. So it is, it's a... It would be like a small cast picture, you know.
Yeah,
it would be a small cast picture with a one or two sets, and maybe you'd have to have a few flashbacks to that second movie. But it's pretty isolated. And again, I tried to play in all three books with some of the classic scenarios of mystery fiction that I love so much. You know, in the first one, it's very much a police procedural where it's this cop.
Sure.
He still has his badge. Second one is it's almost a missing person. And it starts with a beautiful woman coming to him and saying, can you please help me? You know, and there's
it's
all
very
these
film noir.
Very film noir, these levels of deception. And then the third one, it's I don't know exactly what it is, but there's an element of the locked room mystery where, you know, there's been this crime or these crimes committed. And because no one can go anywhere, and there's not, you know, it's all very isolated. You know, like the classic Agatha Christie's or P.D. James novels, they're off in the countryside. And it could only have been one of four people. It never turns out to be someone who wandered in, you know, then wandered away again. So you have a sense of the cast of suspects. So I wanted to get a little
That's
bit of that.
That's pretty cool.
Even as we're right at the end of the world.
I could not wait to read this. I'm so excited about this.
Thanks, Travis.
It's a fun. I love mysteries anyway, and this is such a, you know, it's an interesting mix of science fiction and mystery, and just very clever literature. You know, I know you write a lot of other things as well. You've done some really fun books, Sense and Sensibility and Sea Monsters. You've also done some children's books, in fact, or young adult books that actually feature a young girl detective.
Yes.
And stuff. You know, quite a wide variety of things that you're doing, Ben.
Yeah. Well, you know, I like to keep busy, and I do. I like you, Travis. I love mysteries, and they've become really almost my obsession. And I actually just I teach at Butler and the MFA program, and I got to do a seminar on mystery writing, and my thesis of that class is that there's so much that all of us, writers of all kinds and readers of all kinds, can learn from the great mystery writers about what makes fiction and movies and everything, what makes it work. The buildup of suspense, the drama that comes from conflict, these questions of motivation, like I was talking about with Detective Palace. The really great mystery writers are masters of that, of those things that in all works of fiction make it come to life.
So may I ask what's next for you, man?
Well, you may. I'm working on a new book. You know, that's what we do. I'm about a quarter way into a new novel that is set here in Indianapolis. I've actually, as you know, I've only been in the city for a couple of years, and I've started to feel like I've got a story I can tell. I did a couple ride-alongs with some cops here. I've been doing a bunch of interviews with folks, and I'm getting my mind around a project that I want to do here.
Excellent.
A missing person story, contemporary Indianapolis. So. I will let you know how it goes.
Please do. Please do. Ben, congratulations again on the completion of the Last Policeman trilogy. Great stuff, and looking forward to more.
Thank you very much. See you soon, Travis.
Travis DiNicola with author Ben Winters. His newest book, World of Troubles, comes out everywhere on July 15th. However, you can pre-order now through his publisher and Quirk Books, and you just might win a prize. That's at quirkbooks.com, quirkbooks.com. Or you can get your copy even sooner and meet Ben Winters at Indie Reads Books on Mass Ave for the official early release party on Saturday, July 12th at 1 p.m. More information at indiereadsbooks.org. Ooh.
Ah.
Oh, look at that one. I love the bluey purple ones.
Those are pretty fantastic, Sharon. Well, as all the dogs and children are running to cover their ears, we are here looking at fireworks and celebrating that calendar we call
What'll We Do? Star Spangled Edition.
What a lovely idea.
I love that. Hey, I have something you might want to consider. If, in fact, yes, I know the 4th of July is Friday, but if you're hearing a Saturday morning, you know there's a fireworks display somewhere in your world still tonight. So if you are one of those folks who takes photos on your smartphone, listen up, because the JCC is having a contest and exhibition, Snap Post Share iPhone Art, it's called, and it's a mobile device photography competition. Even though it has iPhone in the title, you can use other kinds of phones, so don't worry about that. They're looking for photos and images shot and processed with apps on any and all mobile phones or tablets. No image alteration from a desktop or laptop is permitted. You can compress file size and change file titles and upload from a desktop or laptop. They just don't want you to go in and Photoshop. Anyway, the submission deadline is coming up on July 25th. If you want more information, you can give a call to 317-715-9233. 317-715-9233, or email L. Rothenberg, Rothenberg, at jccindy.org. L. Rothenberg at jccindy.org. The exhibit will be up on August 13th through September 5th, and you'll learn more about that on a future show.
Nice. That sounds great. Hey, the Symphony is doing their free Concerts in the Park series. Well, we just missed one. The one at Garfield Park took place on Tuesday the 1st. But the next one is at Ellenberger Park, and that is near Irvington, of course, part of Irvington. And it is Tuesday, July 8th at 8 p.m., and Community Health is the sponsor, and since there is limited parking, Community Hospital East at 16th and Ritter is providing free parking and a shuttle service to the park for the concert, though you may want to just consider riding your bike. It's a lovely place to do so, and that concert is going to feature a performance of American and Russian masterpieces led by ISO assistant conductor David Glover. And then the week after, on Wednesday, July 16th at 8 p.m., the Holiday Park Concert, and that's the final concert of their Symphony in the Park series. series, and that's going to be a whole bunch of big band favorites as well. And so again, the next two free concerts, Ellenberger on Tuesday the 8th at 8 p.m. and Holiday Park Wednesday the 16th at 8 p.m. as well.
One more ISO note. This isn't free, but it's pretty darn close. They're $5 lunchtime concerts. Draw to an end next Thursday. That's July 10th. It's downtown at Hilbert Circle Theater. Doors open at 11:30. Concert's 30 to 40 minutes, and the concert begins at 12:15. You're welcome to bring your own lunch, and yes, you can take it right into the theater with you. So a lot of fun, something casual. Go into the air conditioning and hear some fabulous music. Again, ISO lunch break. Last concert is next Thursday, July 10th.
Sounds like a great idea. Hey, a show that is opening up at the Vonnegut Library. Jonathan McAfee, he's a local artist, and he's painted a whole bunch of portraits of Kurt Vonnegut. They're really fantastic. I saw a little preview of some of this work, and fantastic work. The show's title is What People Like About Me is Indianapolis. It comes from a speech that Vonnegut gave here in 86. And so McAfee is doing a series of paintings. It opens on July 11th. Opening reception is from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Vonnegut Library, and of course Indy's Vonnegut inspired restaurant Bluebeard is catering the event, and that should be very cool as well. The exhibit will stay on display through July 31st at the Vonnegut Library down on Senate Avenue. And we'll be back next week with that calendar we call
What do we do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
At the turn of the last century, Americans didn't have an artistic identity. Painter William Forsyth was one of the several high-profile Hoosiers who set out to change that. William J. Forsyth, The Life and Work of an Indiana Artist, is a richly illustrated new biography by Rachel Berenson Perry. Sharon Gamble asked Rachel how Forsyth helped shape our modern identity and why she was attracted to this cantankerous fellow.
What drew you to this particular artist?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because Forsyth has always fascinated me because of his personality and the fact that his artwork seems a lot more spontaneous and, it's just different from the other members of the Hoosier Group who mm-hmm. were the early Indiana artists who became the Hoosier Group in 1894 when they had an exhibit in Chicago and were recognized as very prominent Midwestern artists. Most of them had studied in Munich and then come back to Indiana to paint what they knew best. And so they were really groundbreaking at that time. They had to create their own market for landscapes. And Forsyth was a big component of that. But he also spent many, many years teaching. So he influenced a lot of the next generation of Indiana artists, and he had a very cantankerous personality. And so I found that I wanted to research him because I was interested in his personality. He was really a jerk, but one reason why he became endearing to me when I was reading his letters was because he was very aware of the fact that he was a jerk. So I have this quote that I can read that's relevant to that.
Please.
It says something to that. And this is part in the book. To one whose watchword is progress, it is a humiliating fact to find himself making a series of miserable, contemptible failures, one after another. And he realizes the depths and wonders how he could ever have been the conceited jackass he once was, and supposing that he could create anything. Then, in the midst of his dejection and humiliation, he suddenly finds his fellow students hovering around his easel and murmuring words of praise, approbation, and finally wakes up to the fact that he has made something better than he's ever done before and becomes conceited and arrogant and hopeful as he ever was. So he was very strong opinions about art and was never shy about expressing them. And then later, when he came back to the United States, he did seem to be rather arrogant. He didn't ever kowtow to the powers that be. He wasn't diplomatic. He picked fights with other artists. He especially disliked or seemed to be very jealous of T.C. Steele and picked fights with him all the time. And so a lot of people, he was pugnacious. He really, a lot of people, I think, probably disliked him. But then when he got married to one of his students, Alice Atkinson, she kind of mellowed him out a lot, and she would kind of go around and clean up after his indiscretions. And I think he also, the fact that he was so loyal to his family and really, really adored his three daughters and was very loyal to his wife, endear him. Those things also endeared him to me.
Yeah, if anybody needed a softening influence, having three daughters as well as a wife would, you would think, might do it.
Right.
I also get the impression he was a little bit of a procrastinator. Like he loved to paint in the fall and he loved to go various places like Brookville or Cedar Farm.
Right.
And it's like every fall, it was a little harder for him to come back.
Right. That was, he very much was a procrastinator and also seemed to forget to do things. He had his family. He was very tight with his brothers and sisters, and they were always helping him or reminding him that he needed to do certain things. And certainly when he was the president of the Society of Western Artists later in life, he actually might have been one of the causes of the demise of the organization because he failed to do some of the things that needed to be done, the bureaucratic things that needed to be done. But the thing about his doing his plein air or outside painting in the summers and in the fall, it was something that he enjoyed so much. And going back to Indianapolis in the winter to be a teacher represented going back to the grindstone and going
and the
back
bureaucracy
regular
too, right?
The bureaucracy, the regular hours, mm-hmm. And also because he did have, or he thought that he had so many enemies in the city, he also felt, I guess, threatened to a certain extent as well.
So it's only a little over a century ago we're talking about, and it seems strange to us now, but can you give us a little more context about why artists around the turn of the last century felt like they had to go away to study, and why it was really kind of a radical move to paint scenes from here in our state?
Right. At that time, in the late 1800s, the people who had means, really the status symbol was to buy traditional European artwork, and there really weren't any art schools around Indiana around the 1880s. It was very difficult to get instruction, so unless you kind of apprenticed with a particular artist, you didn't have any opportunity to get instruction. Really, the only schools were in Europe, but it was also felt that you had to do that. You had to go to Europe to become a real artist. And then when they came back, a lot of people became expatriates. Like Frank Duveneck, who was in Ohio, kept going back to Europe. A lot of artists went back to Europe or went to the East Coast, where there was more of an art market. But to come back to Indiana, to the Midwest, where there really wasn't much of an art market, was considered to be very brave. They did still submit their paintings to Eastern exhibits in Pennsylvania and New York, and actually got into the exhibits, but their names weren't known. So it was very difficult for them to get any traction for selling artwork. So the only things really that you could do when they came back and make a living were painting portraits, commissioned portraits, or teaching. And by the time William Forsythe came back to the United States. For Steele had already been back for a couple of years, and when T.C. Steele returned, he had to paint portraits for all of the patrons who had given him money to study in Europe, and he was on the north side of Indianapolis, while he was really at 16th and Pennsylvania.
Which was the north side.
Exactly, which was the north side. And so his neighbors were wealthy people, and he quickly established a market. He was painting all the most important people in Indianapolis, and it was considered to be a status symbol to have your portrait painted by T.C. Steele. So by the time Forsyth came back to Indiana, the market was kind of sewn up. And really, the truth is that Forsyth didn't really have the kind of diplomatic personality that would have been required to paint portraits anyway. But he always resented the fact that when he came back, he didn't have an opportunity to paint, to try to make a living from painting portraits. Forsyth also was from a real blue-collar family. He lived on the South Side, and the whole family depended on these contracted jobs. They were house painters. So he really culturally was from a very different background than T.C. Steele, who T.C. Steele's grandparents had the first brick house in Owen County and pianos and libraries, and they were a very educated and cultured family compared to Forsyth, who was much more hard-scrabble, blue-collar. And it's interesting to realize that those class distinctions, if you will, existed back then as they do today.
And might have even have been harder to transcend back then.
Right.
Because there's no, you know, social media evening things out for everybody.
Right. And you just wouldn't be hanging around he wouldn't have been hanging around in the same circles as T.C. Steele from the very beginning, even if they hadn't been artists. But Forsyth had the passion. He was extremely passionate about living his life as an artist. And he became a really sought after teacher because he was able to translate that passion to other people. But he didn't have any patience at all for people who were dilettantes or who he considered to be people who really weren't taking art seriously. If you did take art seriously, he became a loyal friend for life. He would continue corresponding. He'd help you find a job and, you know, help you network in that way.
But again, that probably put him in a bad position because a lot of the people when he was teaching who might have been candidates to be students were well-bred daughters of well-to-do people or
he didn't teach those people.
No,
of course, when he first,
it was harder, I'm sure.
Right. When he first came back, he did open a school with J. Otis Adams and Muncie, and they definitely had, I think they were all women in those classes, so they would have been wealthier women who were rounding out their cultural education by taking art classes.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So tell us about the role of the Society of Western Artists, and starting with explaining the name and why is the Society of Western Artists here in Indiana?
Right. The Society of Western Artists started in 1896, and at the time, we were the West. The Midwest was the West because they considered California to be the Far West. So really, the Midwest was referred to as the West. And it goes back to what I was saying before, where all the major exhibitions were on the East Coast. And so three major artists from each of the cities of St. Louis and Cleveland and Cincinnati and Indianapolis and Detroit got together and formed the society so that they could have an annual exhibition that would travel to all of the membership cities. And it was a force to be reckoned with and really did kind of freak out the East Coast organizers because they saw this major exhibition that was traveling all year to the different cities. And it was very efficient at gaining publicity, but unfortunately it didn't really translate into sales. So eventually, after around 1914, the society disbanded, and it was completely organized by artists. So you can imagine it was probably a nightmare.
Although, as you've pointed out in the book, Forsyth had maybe not equal skills, but certainly laudable skills as a writer,
yes,
as well
did.
As a
yes,
visual artist,
did.
Which, and those things usually do not occur in the same brain.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. I do think that Forsyth was certainly much more prolific, and he was much clearer. His thoughts were much more clear than T.C. Steele's. I can still read essays that Steele wrote that I don't really understand mm-hmm. what he's trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
But Forsyth was more, I would say, publicly oriented. He was able to write about art in a way that was easily understood by the general public, sort of like me. I don't consider myself to be an art historian, but I think I can write about art history in a way that's readable for people who may not be that interested in art.
Very accessible.
Very accessible,
yeah.
Right.
Hey, speaking of access, so people who read this are going to be excited to know about an exhibit you're working on organizing this fall.
Right. That's going to be at the Indiana State Museum. It opens November 8th, and then it'll be there until March 29th of 2015. And it's called William Forsyth, Only the Strong Persist. Because that's a direct quote from Forsyth, who felt that to be an artist, you had to be extremely tenacious.
Sharon Gamble with Rachel Berenson-Perry, author and retired fine arts curator of the Indiana State Museum. William J. Forsyth, The Life and Work of an Indiana Artist, is published by the Indiana University Press. You can learn more at their website or from any brick-and-mortar bookseller. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when we'll continue our summer reading series as I chat with poet Norbert Croft.
And I'll chat with poet Liza Hyatt. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.